You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
I like that I look far more polished than you right now. Not that I look polished based on the average of America.
Yes.
Just I look more polished than you, which is not the usual order of things in the DMZ.
Well, you have a haircut, it looks like.
No, I don't have a haircut. I just took a shower. A haircut.
Okay. Well, Bill, this is part of a theme of you living the life of a Christian conservative and a straight-laced person and me being, you know, a little wild, a little rebellious.
Let's be straight here, Matt. If, for those who can't see you because they're listening to the podcast – like, you're now in straight-up hippie mode right now. If I saw you walking down the street, I'd be like, who is that stinky hippie? That's what I would say. Hey, hippie punchers, let's go beat up that guy.
I just did. I just taped. There's this show called Political Beats that is a podcast on National Review where they talk to political people about a different musical act. And I just did an episode on John Cougar Mellencamp.
Wow.
And I feel like I'm entering with my hair. I feel like I'm entering into the Lonesome Jubilee phase, which if you've seen the Cherry Bomb video, that's the mode I'm going into, I think.
All right.
It's a look.
I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't work for you, Matt. I'm just saying if I saw you on the street and I wanted to punch a hippie, I would punch you. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's where you'd be surprised because Kitty's got claws. So what are we talking about this week, Bill?
So, you know, last night or yesterday was the advancement in the House. They passed the budget resolution, and at the same time, in a single bill, passed a rule that fixes a date for consideration of the bipartisan infrastructure bill on September 27th. And so now, perhaps it's a small corner of the universe, perhaps most people in America are focused on COVID and Afghanistan, but in this little corner of the Twitterverse that I live in, people are spinning wildly over who got the better end of this deal. I made an argument.
So, but weren't there nine Democrats who were not going to let this happen?
When it went up to 10
moderates.
So it's right, 10 moderates. And the initial demand, when it was nine, was we won't consider the budget resolution until the bipartisan infrastructure bill passes the House and is signed into law. So that did not happen yesterday. So they did not get their demand. So what did they get is the question. And what I would argue is what they really want. I mean, the reason why they wanted to have it signed to law was to sort of cleanly de-link it from reconciliation. They don't want there to be it be perceived as one giant bill of all the Democratic wish list priorities. They want there to be a clean, standalone bipartisan bill. So there are headlines that say bipartisan bill signed into law. There's a signing ceremony when they're Democrats and Republicans. They can use those images in ads at home. That's what they want. And I would not argue that it is guaranteed that they get that from this deal, but I think they're in a pretty good position to get it from this deal, because they have a fixed date for consideration of it. It's not, that date is not tied to what happens reconciliation. Now, it may be the reconciliation gets passed before then or on that day.
Wait, what is the date?
September 27th.
It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems implausible to me that the reconciliation bill could be ready by that date.
I mean, that is part of my argument. It is theoretically possible, but you're talking, I would argue, the biggest piece of legislation in the history of America. This is not a small bill. There are many, many facets to the bill. There is not an agreement what the top line number should be. And we haven't even, I don't even know what other points of disagreements may exist. Like that, people haven't even, you know, engaged in the particulars of universal pre-K, community college, long-term elder care, immigration pathway, climate. I mean, this has to get through Joe Manchin. You know, this climate stuff here has to get through Joe Manchin. And all the pay-fors. I mean, what Manchin has said and what some of the House moderates have said is, let's see what tax revenue we can agree upon, and that should determine the size of the bill. And what are the things we want in there? We should calculate from the bottom up, not have an arbitrary top line and work backwards. So all that stuff is not determined yet. Now, what Pelosi said on Tuesday was that we should pass a, you know, they don't call it reconciliation. They're trying to say this is the Build Back Better plan. They're trying to use that that framing because reconciliation is, you know, obviously jargon inside baseball jargon. So Pelosi says
has a negative connotation because it means it's not bipartisan.
But to people who even know reconciliation is like reconciliation actually sounds bipartisan. It's something we got together reconciled.
Fair point.
Pelosi said, we want a Build Back Better plan that can pass the Senate. So what that infers is we don't want a House bill that's going to lead to a different Senate bill that has to then be, you know, renegotiated in a House Senate conference. Let's just pass something that they're going to rubber stamp, and that way we can get done faster. This puts the progressives in a bit of a bind. If you want to pass reconciliation before the 27th, you can't have it get hung up in the Senate. You need to get something that they want to pass. But to the progressive caucus, they don't want to be under the thumb of the 50th vote in the Senate.
Yeah.
They want to put forth an aggressive bill and try to squeeze them. So that all has to get hashed out.
And so it seems implausible to me. So the bipartisan bill has already passed the Senate.
Right.
The House just has to pass it. Biden could sign it tomorrow, probably, or something like that. Right.
Well,
but now he can't because there's a date of September 27th. Is that what he said?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's assume, and I think it would be implausible that the Build Back Better reconciliation bill will be ready in time. Let's say we get to September 27th.
Okay.
And it's not ready.
Right.
Does the House pass the bipartisan bill, and does Joe Biden sign it without the reconciliation?
Two big factors here. So number one, after this deal got done yesterday and the moderate 10, you know, got Josh Guyer put out a statement saying, you know, this is great. We've delinked this standalone vote. Will be judged on its own merits. The Progressive Caucus chair put out a letter saying, this doesn't change anything for us. We're not passing this thing until the Senate passes reconciliation first. So it's not a guarantee that you have 217 votes, you know, in the House on September 27th. It's just a fixed date for consideration. Now, here's the other big factor.
Wait, I'm sorry. What does consideration mean?
I believe it would get a vote. It would at least get
so put Nancy forward. Pelosi has basically committed to putting it on the floor for a vote.
I mean, I think there's a little bit of, you know, difference of interpretation about that. I think you at least begin that process. You'd say, here is the day we debate and have the vote. I suppose it's possible you have some, you know, perfunctory debate, and then Pelosi says, the votes aren't here, no vote, but it's been considered. That's a little fuzzy. And to your other point that you mentioned earlier, there's nothing in that agreement that says Biden signs it, even if it passes. I mean, Pelosi could literally not even bring it to the White House. However, existing law that has authorized federal highway and transit money through the Highway Trust Fund, that expires on September 30th. You have what is, you know, something we call things a fiscal cliff when certain things, certain deadlines are. This is a highway cliff. if there's nothing passed by the 30th, federal money to existing infrastructure projects gets yanked. Now, you know, maybe this, if it gets yanked for 3 days and then it comes later, like, things don't get too disrupted, but you're running that risk that existing projects get stalled. And Democrats, here they are running on Build Back Better. I mean, if there's anything about Biden's domestic agenda, it is infrastructure. So it's a little dicey to be the party that has stalled infrastructure projects across America. So that's going to be something that gives, I mean, not just the moderates, Pelosi has said is that she commits to rallying Democratic support for this bill. She said, I'm going to whip for this. There's a reason why she's saying that. Some of them might think, oh, this is just talk from Pelosi. She doesn't have to follow through. She's going to follow through most likely because of the highway cliff. And Biden's probably going to sign it because of the highway cliff. I think that's why the moderates accepted this on its face, because that is looming over their heads. And if progressives want to say, we want to whip against it, they're going to have to go to members and argue it's okay to go over this cliff because we're going to win out better at the end of the day. And that to me seems, I mean, it doesn't guarantee moderates get this, but I think that puts them in the more favorable position.
But it's not like a fiscal cliff that would wreak havoc on the country if it doesn't pass.
I mean, depending on what the, you know, people's jobs might be involved, you know, I mean, it's not literally the entire government shutting down, but you might have lots of news stories in local communities, maybe in swing states, maybe in vulnerable House member districts. You know, such and such highway repair, such and such bridge repair, ceased operation. Those are headlines that Democrats want to see.
Now, let me ask you this. So Joe Biden gets elected president. He comes in. He's going to be the next FDR. He's going to be the next LBJ. He passes the COVID stimulus, and that's it, okay? Now he is embroiled in what I assume we're going to talk about later, Afghanistan, which does not seem to be going well at the moment. It would be nice for Joe Biden, I would assume, to get a win, to like get one more big piece of legislation, like the bipartisan infrastructure deal, a feather in his cap, an accomplishment, points on the board. Is there a chance that this whole thing, like not just the Build Back Better part of it, but that both bills could be scuttled due to this back and forth, you know, gamesmanship?
I mean, I think it's one of those, you know, there's a chance, but this is so, you know, crucial. I mean, this is the president's agenda. Like, this is it. This is the domestic agenda. So you're basically dooming the party for the foreseeable future if you don't get it done. You know, there are people constantly yelling at me because I'm giving these analyses where I say, look, I think the moderates got the better hand here. And so people will say, you know, why do you want to tank reconciliation? Why are you trying to help these moderates tank reconciliation? I'm like, what evidence do I have that they want to tank reconciliation? Do they want it smaller than the progressives do? Most likely. Sinema has been very pointed about that.
Just saying as an analyst that you think the moderates have a better hand does not mean that you want that to be the case, even if you do. It doesn't mean that. It just means you believe that they have a better hand.
It doesn't.
Right?
And look, people who follow us, people who care about this issue, you know, read what I've written on the subject and read some of the counter analyses that are out there. You can read Jonathan Chait. You can read Greg Sargent. You could read David Dayan, American Prospect. You read Ryan Grimm with The Intercept. I mean, just read them. I mean, look, go in with an open mind. And I don't want to nitpick and go through one line by line. I just find that a lot of the other pieces I've seen strike me more as spin than analysis. I mean, I'm trying to do my best to show my work. I mean, it doesn't mean to make me right, but I'm trying to, these are the reasons why I'm coming to these conclusions. I'm not working backwards from what can I do to make moderates look good? Okay, I'll come up with these random things. Like, I'm trying to lay all the factors, the things that the progressives want, things that the moderates want, trying to synthesize it all together. And the point in doing that, I mean, when it's over, but ahead of time, I mean, the point of doing it is to strategize. I mean, wherever you are on the spectrum, ideologically, whatever you want the outcome to be, you better understand where power actually lies and what are the actual motivations driving the different players or you're going to make bad calls. I think.
I agree. I understand that the moderates, the 9 or 10 moderates, are still in the game, and they probably still have the upper hand, based on everything we've just said. Why, though, didn't they just stick to their guns and just say, no, this is a line in the sand. We're not going to vote on this resolution until we vote to pass the bipartisan bill. Why didn't they just stick to their guns?
This is what I think. I mean, I can't know. It's what I think. Pelosi is going to do what gets the 217, in my opinion. Who gets the 217 first wins. If there are 217 for a budget resolution, you do that. There's 217 for bipartisan infrastructure, you do that. And for reconciliation, too. For the moderates to have, you know, succeed in shooting the moon, they would have to, you know, block the resolution repeatedly. You know, whatever you came with them with, nope, 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 nothing, nothing, nothing. At some point, the bluff gets called, and Pelosi can say, "Okay, show me your 217." And I think there was a non-zero chance that you could go to the bulk of the Democrat caucus and say, "Look, we are never going to move, never, ever, 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 and the only path forward is pass this infrastructure bill first. I don't care how mad it makes Jayapal and AOC and Omar, it is this or nothing, so you better do it." I think that could have worked, but it would have, one, you know, I think caused a lot of Bruce feelings.
Yeah.
And two, you couldn't know that you have 217, especially without not having Pelosi's help in advance. You're making a bet that you're going to get there, that because Pelosi is going to eventually come around and say, okay, I got no choice here. Yeah. But you couldn't line it all up right then and there. Now, so here comes Pelosi saying, look, I'm going to give you a fixed day. There is this highway cliff. This money wasn't going to get spent before October 1st because we're still under the existing law. So we're not delaying anything. And I'm giving you my word that I'm going to whip for this on the 27th. So that, I would think, was the calculation. You know what? This is the safer course. We're still going to get to where we want to go. I don't have like an ironclad guarantee, but in all likelihood, it's going to work out in my favor, and I got Pelosi's help on it. That's what I think.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. All right. What now?
People should keep in mind here, we got a hell of a September coming. Because not only are we negotiating reconciliation, which I think is going to be messy in and of itself, there's also legislation needed to keep the government open at the end of September through the various appropriations bills. And we have the debt limit, which Treasury has said they're in their extraordinary measures phase where they are preventing default by, you know, gimmicks and stuff, which they said they're going to do through September 30th. Now, I don't know if they had the latitude to go beyond September 30th. So maybe this was like a preliminary deadline, then we're going to get to the 28th, and nothing's happening in Congress. They say, okay, we can keep going. We can go to November 1st or whatever. So that may be the case. But if they can't, how is that getting done? I mean, this is, you know, default on the debt is like a global economic crisis. McConnell has said, don't expect our votes on this. We're not going to help you here. This is on you're spending trillions of dollars. This is on you. Now, of course, remember, the debt limit is not about paying for future debts. It's about paying for past debts. This is about paying for stuff that Republicans put on the credit card over the last 4 years. But of course, that people don't always understand that. If Democrats are going to do this through reconciliation, as we just discussed, that may not be ready by September 30th. And one of the hangups with reconciliation is, you can do budgetary things with reconciliation, you can't do policy. So from what I understand, they could say in reconciliation, the debt limit is now $50 gazillion. They can't say the debt limit is suspended, which is what they have been doing recently, to not have to bother with having a number that people have put their name to. Republicans didn't want to say we've made our debt limit $50 gazillion and have that thrown back in their faces. So And then and some of the House, some of the Democratic moderates seem reluctant to take that on too. So we don't know if Democrats can get that debt and reconciliation in time. And if they have to go to the Republicans and say, gee, we really need you guys to suspend the debt limit or else we're going to have a global economic crisis. Now you're negotiating with Republicans over that. And what are they going to ask in return? So it's a lot happening in September that, I mean, truly, if Pelosi and Schumer can get out of it, they are like the greatest legislative maestros in all of history, because this is a lot to put on anybody.
And September 11th, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, will also be in September.
Yep.
And in light of what's happening in Afghanistan, that date will take on even more importance symbolically. And who knows, there may be the Taliban or Al-Qaeda may decide to release something that day as well.
Now, we talked Afghanistan last week. You have been, you know, severely critical of Biden.
Severely.
I mean,
I'd say appropriately critical.
Well, I mean, that's obviously a matter of opinion, but you've had very strong words, and I, as obsessed as I've been a bit about this infrastructure reconciliation stuff, you've been primarily focused on Afghanistan the past several days, correct?
Between the two of us, we really have politics covered right now.
So I want to ask you, I feel I've picked up some commentary in the past week of the lines of, hey, at least no Americans have been killed. The airlift has been ramped up. Maybe some Afghans are starting to push back on the Taliban. The Taliban have their work cut out for them because they don't know how to govern a country well. Maybe the jury's out here how this all ends up. And by the way, most Americans want to get out anyway. Does any of that resonate with you, make you give you a more nuanced take on the matter? Or are you still just like, you know what, then just watch this and there's no excusing it?
None of it persuades me at all, but I do think you're right, Bill, that the media narrative is shifting. I think that initially the media narrative was where I am. Mm-hmm. And I think in recent days, all those arguments that you just cited have started to congeal and become not quite conventional wisdom, but like the line. And so although I am not persuaded by it, I definitely think that that is kind of the trend in the media.
I mean, is there something to the argument that what the status quo in Afghanistan was not good? There's tons of corruption. They weren't getting their own act together, and they just can't get their own act together while we're there propping them up. That they need to go through this phase. And granted, the outcome would be uncertain. But if they're ever going to get their act together, they're just going to have to do it on their own. And we were getting in their way. So whatever short-term consequence there is, it's better for them in the long run to figure it out on their own.
It's like dumping your kids off in New York City and saying, like, they're going to have to make it on their own. We'll see. I mean, like, the Taliban is taking over. We know how it's going to go. There's not really a question of, like, it's going to be bad. And so I don't think that's a legitimate argument. And besides, my premise here was never that nation building. Honestly, over time, if we were able to stay in Afghanistan, keep a residual force there, maintain order, you know, we were starting to get to a point where eventually there were going to, like, literally be generations of people who came of age in a better Afghanistan, of, you know, girls who went to school and maybe over time. But I'm not optimistic about exporting democracy and nation building. So that was never really the driving interest. It was really keeping the country from falling apart as it has, and preventing Al-Qaeda and ISIS and other terrorist groups from that safe haven And I suspect that it's going to, it seems like all the things that I would have worried about are actually happening.
You know, I just heard on CNN before we started that there's ISIS-K, which I never heard of before. ISIS-K is president of Afghanistan now, and we have to watch out for them. And it always just sort of strikes me. In my presidential book club, we just went through, I think I mentioned this before, went through McKinley, the book, The President and the Assassin, and he was felled by an anarchist. And there was this a period of time when there was a lot of anarchist bombings, and they were terrorizing the world, and a lot of world leaders were taken out by anarchist violence. And I just feel like so much world history is driven by just young male idiots hopped up on their testosterone. And so we, like, what if you're younger, you're like ISIS-K, you know, this evil ISIS-K. And I'm kind of like, what stupid 21-year-old is doing what damage now? Can we just, yeah. I mean, you know, the two points are not in opposition.
Basically, we should put, men should not be released from jail until we turn 30. You know, essentially the world would be a better place. I mean, it's, you know, that it's pretty much right. I mean, like, crime, whatever. I mean, it's perpetrated by young men.
So you don't have any faith that Biden can maintain a good counterterrorism strategy with an Afghanistan pullout.
Look, I think there's a chance that Biden is able to spin this and escape with his, you know, escape with his political life. But I don't think there's really any way that what has happened here will turn out to be positive. There's just so many. I mean, we're already seeing. I mean, Bill, when's the last time you heard of ISIS? Until a week ago, like, we have basically vanquished ISIS. I mean, I think Donald Trump has a decent shot of becoming the next president now. You know what I mean? Like, at least we didn't have, I could forget about international terrorism during that time. I mean,
there's a little matter that he cut the deal with the Taliban in the first place.
Oh, well, for people, you know, you and I know that. But, like, will the average person? I mean, sadly, no. But you're right. I mean, Trump deserves a ton of blame, obviously, for the deal. But, like, that will be memory hold, as you know. You know, China is seeing what we're doing. Like, if you're Taiwan, how do you feel right now about it? I mean, like, we have betrayed our ally, our friends and allies, and certainly have not demonstrated loyalty. We've demonstrated that we are incompetent and that we lack resolve. I mean, all of these things invite provocation from China and Russia, not to mention now the potential for international terrorism. I think it's pretty likely we're going to leave Americans behind. I mean, it's sort of like the whole thing about, like, can the reconciliation bill be ready by September 27th? Like, maybe, but I wouldn't think so. And the same thing here. It seems like we're probably going to end up leaving a lot of Americans behind. And what's going to happen to them? And once we're gone, the incentive for good behavior is gone. So when 9/11, the anniversary of 9/11 comes around, what kind of images may serve? You know, I don't see any way that this is a good thing. It's really hard for me to understand why Joe Biden did this and allowed this to happen. I can't. There have been obviously, and, you know, bad things happen in history, but I can't think of another example of someone invite sort of like going out of their way to invite this kind of thing to happen as Biden did. It's really boggles the mind, Bill.
Well, again, as I said in the last show, not a foreign policy expert, not an Afghanistan expert by any stretch. So I'm not going to say, I know this is going to happen. I know that's going to happen because I don't know anything. I do think, but I do want to entertain alternative possibilities. I mean, I think it's possible that even if people make the conclusions that you drew, that those will be wrong conclusions. That's it's better for America to not be sinking costs into Afghanistan to free us up to do a pivot to Asia or to deal with other international problems. If someone thinks, oh, America has weak resolve, let's punch him between the eyes, and they find out the next day that wasn't the best idea. As Osama bin Laden found out, he thought, oh, they pulled out a Lemadon, let's knock down the towers. That wasn't a great idea for Osama bin Laden, because we came back, you know, in a fury. So it's not like America never has resolve or never stands up for itself. There's certainly, I think the proper conclusion to draw is that you can't count on America to do something altruistic year after year after year after year without you showing progress, because there's no inherent appetite for that in the American body politic. At some point, they're going to say, this is not important to us anymore.
I think that's demonstrably correct. However, I just think we need to reevaluate our expectations. Like, for me, we were winning in Afghanistan because it was a stalemate. That's winning. Like, not losing is win. Like, if you have a small, fairly small residual force and you're not suffering a lot of casualties and the country has not descended into chaos, and it is not being used as a staging ground for a terrorist attack, for allowing groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda to reform, you're winning. And that's sort of the burden. That's the price of doing business.
I mean, the people who believe that, people who want to see us stay there, needed to make that argument a long time ago and didn't. I mean, I saw a piece in the Times by Ryan Crocker, who was, I think, ambassador to Afghanistan. Forgive me if I'm getting his title wrong. And he was lamenting that we didn't stay, and said that we could have stayed indefinitely. That there were things that we were doing that were good for us at low cost to America. We weren't taking on a lot of casualties as of late, and we could have stayed indefinitely and maintained those benefits. I'm not saying this is the right argument. I'm not saying I know anything. All I'm saying is nobody made that argument for years.
Well, for years, and I think that would have been the role that a Republican would have played if it wasn't Donald Trump, right? I mean, traditionally, like at least in the modern era, that's the role of the Republic, you know, theoretically, and there are exceptions, but like theoretically, that's the function of a healthy Republican Party, is to be that check. And to make that argument, maybe you lose that argument, but at least to make that argument rhetorically, to provide that kind of leadership. And Donald Trump did not do it.
Three presidents
without anybody making the case.
Man, forgive me, I haven't gone back and checked everyone's, you know, transcripts on this. I'm not even sure in the Bush years people would say, oh yeah, we can stay indefinitely, that's a good idea. But we just need to be there. It's just a volatile region of the world. It's very corrupt. There's a lot of bad actors. And look, we got to be there. We don't need to put our boot on people's necks. We're not trying to be an irritant, but it's in their interest and our interest for us to stay for as long as it takes. I do not recall Bill making this case in the last decade.
Like, number one, it's a hard argument to make. But we do it in Korea. We do it in Germany. Nobody talks about it, though. We don't talk about it. And I don't even know. I mean, Donald Trump, you know, sort of was the first guy to really kind of question whether we ought to be doing that. You know, I don't even know how popular it is. Like, if we took a vote, should we still be in Germany? Should we, you know, I don't know that the American public would, you know, we don't think about it, but given the choice, we'd probably be like, probably not. A lot of Americans probably, but we do it ideally, I think, because our leaders recognize that it provides, if nothing else, strategic benefit. Like, Bill, if we had Bagram Air Base, that might come in handy one day. Like, are we better off not having that? Are we better off having fled it in the middle of the night, snuck out of there without telling anybody and leaving behind a lot of equipment in the process? Like, wouldn't America be better served by having that base? I think certainly so.
all I know is you can't expect politicians to want to be responsible for that and stay there without having any kind of bottom-up push from the people themselves. I mean,
I disagree. I think that this is actually more a leadership-driven problem. I think that we went three presidents with nobody making the case for this at all. And
but you have to make the case for it for the public to support it and give you the support to stay. You know, it's a virtuous cycle. I mean,
I think the American public is inherently against, you know, war. I think the American public are fickle. I think we have a short attention span. And I think we need leaders to make the case. Like, this is why we need to be vigilant. This is why we need to make the sacrifice. This is why we need to be involved. We cannot retreat from the world. We have to be involved or else the bad guys win. And if nobody is making that argument, we shouldn't be surprised when public opinion
That's exactly what I'm saying. You could have had some kind of PR campaign where you featured soldiers from Afghanistan who came home talking about the wonderful things that they did, and interviews with Afghan women and girls, and people in the Afghan civil service saying, you know, we're making progress, and why it's good for America, and why it's good that the region is more stable than it was. Like, none of that argumentation was occurring. And so you can't get the public to see a reason to stay, and you can't get a politician. I mean, arguably a politician shouldn't be strictly driven by polls. Leaders need to be able to look around the corner. If it was, you know, a 90% chance that doing this is going to lead to a terrorist attack on American soil, you would say, who cares what the polls are? I'm just not going to do that.
So that's the big issue. I mean, my main issue with this has always been, I don't think we should be leaving anyway. But let's assume you're going to leave, right? We could talk all day about the debacle that this has become. And I think we're going to leave Americans behind. And now they're talking, you know, about, oh, well, we've evacuated. You know, this is Dunkirk. Well, OK, Dunkirk was not, it was a strategic retreat. You know, the British were being evacuated so they could live to fight another day, so they could keep up the fight. They weren't surrendering and retreating to not fight. So that whole analogy, I think, is really bogus. But we're hearing now, you know, Biden's doing such a great job. They've gotten 40,000 people out since such and such date. And I'm like, well, who are these people? Most of them aren't Americans. I think most of them also are not Afghan interpreters. Now, it may very well be that these are like great Afghans who may become great Americans someday, but it's a misleading thing when you're talking about all the people you're evacuating, but they're not the people who have like the visas or the passports.
Well, I'm not up on the numbers of who's left right now and the expectations of when they would come out.
And then the deadline. You know, this looks so bad. You know, initially it was May 1st. That's the deal that Trump and Pompeo negotiated with the Taliban, right? Supposed to be May 1st. Biden then says 9/11. He then says, okay, we'll do it August 31st. And then it starts to look like we might not be able to get everybody out in time. So Biden starts to say like, well, maybe we'll extend it. And the Taliban says no. And Biden basically says, okay then, we'll do it your way. It doesn't look like we're in charge because we're not in charge.
Well, I'm, again, not being someone who's like super duper up on it. So maybe you shouldn't be listening to me right now. You should go find some foreign policy podcast and not waste your time.
Well, Bill, trust me. I know everything there is about the bipartisan infrastructure bill. So we're even.
Let's see what happens on August 31st if there are still Americans there. I'd be a little surprised if Biden's going to say, sorry, kids, can't help you. I got the sense that Biden was putting a little bit of caveats into that language. I'm sure there's some delicate dance going on with the Taliban in terms of diplomacy and not trying to escalate any kind of tensions.
Maybe they'll let out all the Americans and not the Afghan interpreters. we're at their mercy, basically. I mean, they have the leverage at this point.
I mean, I'm going way beyond, you know, what I can possibly know, but it seems like the Taliban also don't want our ire. They're trying to put forth an image of law and order. I mean, and I fully understand that not everybody, you know, beneath the Taliban leadership is cooperating in that. And
but, you know, the other thing is, I mean, and I know you want to get out of this conversation with that, but because of what we've done, there's now like Al-Qaeda and ISIS that also get a vote, and they could freelance and do something that the Taliban doesn't even approve of, right? And so that's just, you know, another dimension to this.
Well, I mean, we don't know to what extent these different radical militant actors get along with each other, to what extent they're going to be caught going after themselves and less focused on going after us.
Yeah.
There's just so many unknowns here. This is so uncharted. I'm just hard pressed to make an assumption.
Maybe it'll be like the Simpsons, where Mr. Burns has so many diseases and ailments, that they're keeping him, they're all fighting each other and keeping him alive. So.
Is there any other issue that we should touch upon?
I think we've hit the two big topics right now, obviously, without a doubt.
So. Well, actually, I need to write on this, and I haven't done my research on it yet, so forgive me. But what's your thoughts about Biden's poll numbers?
I think Biden is in trouble because his polls were already going down before the Afghanistan debacle. And, you know, Bill, as we've talked about before, Biden didn't win the presidency by virtue of juicing the Obama coalition. He won the presidency by virtue of performing better than most Democrats perform amongst married men and other traditionally, you know, what you might think of nowadays, at least, as being Republican cohorts. And so I just think that Biden's behavior in the last few months he's not doing the things you would do if you cared about keeping the Biden coalition together.
I mean, right now, in the 538 average, Biden's at 47.6 approved, 46.9 disapproved, so not quite underwater, but almost there. And he is underwater in the Real Clear Politics average. You got very bad Suffolk poll number and Rasmussen poll number. 538 is going to adjust those things, and RCP is not. So that's why then you got that discrepancy there. But, you know, it's still a pretty big drop over the course of the past month. I need to go back and just look at the trend lines for past presidents, which is it's not the most extensive research to do in the world. These are not hard numbers to find, but just my recollection is that you had declines in the first year or two, typically. You know, George W. Bush, I think, was kind of inching down, then 9/11 happened and he goes to the roof. But, you know, Clinton had a rough go first year. Obama, I know, he was first underwater March 2010. So in that sense, what happening to Biden here is not crazy. Maybe argue is pretty normal. You know, some crisis happens in a lot of people's watches. Something doesn't go your way the first year. Biden is that being a typical president is not good enough to survive the midterm, because it's typical that the president party loses seats and they're already on a knife's edge in both chambers. So being okay, you know, might be fine as far as 2024 is concerned. But as far as being able to have any control over your domestic agenda in the second half of your first term, unless things pull out and turn around very quickly here, you know, then you have reason for Democrats to be seriously concerned.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned COVID. We haven't mentioned COVID. That's obviously a big part of this story, is the Delta variant. And it's, you know, I just think that that's also the fact that we thought we had kind of gotten COVID behind us and we didn't, is lingering and probably causing Biden, was probably contributing to his numbers before.
I mean, there's an argument this drop is more COVID related than Afghan related. I mean, I've seen some pollsters make that case.
Totally possible. I would say it seems different. With Bill Clinton and Obama, it felt to me like what they were doing, it was exciting and they were overreaching. You know, they're going too far left early on, and the public sort of rebuked them and checked them, right? And Bill Clinton listened to that check and Obama didn't. But they were sort of being dynamic. They were doing things, they were overreaching. And that created a backlash. In the case of Biden, it feels more Jimmy Carter-ish to me. I mean, just in the sense of like, it feels like he's lost control and that he's a victim of events are happening to him. And I can't document it. It's just it's more a feeling that I have. But do you share that feeling, Bill?
Well, I don't fully agree, because at this stage of the Obama presidency, he wasn't firing on all cylinders, legislatively speaking. You know, Recovery Act got passed very quickly by February. And by this point, we were kind of bogged down in the healthcare debate. I mean, this was the town halls. This was the Tea Party. This was a month before Obama comes back to Congress and does his, you know, fact-checking speech, and the congressperson from South Carolina yells, "You lie." This is also after Obama's Henry Louis Gates Beer Summit episode. That was more in the, I think that was July. And that hurt him with white voters very strongly. So I think Obama was not in a great place at this point, although the drop here wasn't, I think, as steep as what you're seeing in Biden now. Well, you know, I got to go look at the numbers. Forgive me. You know, Obama started much higher. Obama started very high, much bigger honeymoon. And so between, you know, January 20 and March 10, you're talking a very long drop. Biden was sort of around mid-50s, kind of steady. You know, it wasn't, you know, fantastical honeymoon period, but relative to our polarizing country, relative to Trump, mid-50s look pretty good. And now we're starting to inch down. And so, you know, I saw Eric Baylor say Biden's only down 3 points in 538 over the past 12 days. Well, sure, but if you're already around low 50s, 3 points is not that insignificant. You know, you want to be in a stronger place than that when you need to be in a really strong place if you're going to do well in the midterm.
I'm also really, you know, I felt like the speech that Biden gave, that big kind of presser he gave last week, where he kind of doubled down on Afghanistan and on, he sort of appeared callous somewhat. I don't know. It seems like he's like losing it to me. I don't mean losing it dementia. I mean like
he's not in control of his narrative as the way he was before.
Not at all. And this is a guy whose narrative was competence, the adults are back, and decency. Look, I'm not the average American. I watch these people more closely, and so I'm probably more put off by it. But like the spin from the Jake Sullivans of the world, and it's, you know.
Well, this is the thing. When you're governing, you can only control so much narrative. The world gets a say in your narrative.
I know, but see, that's the problem with Afghanistan is this didn't need to be a big – like all he had to do was nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand the argument, and maybe it's true. I think the counter argument to that is if Biden tried to stick it out, break the Trump deal – stick around, that there was already Taliban momentum happening and that things were going to escalate. And then Biden would have to, and then Biden would be charged with being sucked into a quagmire. Why aren't you leaving? There's more casualties happening. More Americans are getting killed. Why are you sticking around? You know, so again, I can't know.
Yeah. But I do think it's fair to say that by negotiating with the Taliban and announcing the withdrawal, that Donald Trump did create problems for Joe Biden. There's no doubt about that. And that the Taliban kind of thought it was over once Trump did that it was just a matter of time.
And this is sort of, you know, kind of a parallel to Obama's problem in the first term. The Obama people were saying, well, if we didn't pass the Recovery Act, it would have been so much worse, but you can't prove the counterfactual. You know, Biden can't say, well, it would have been a lot worse if we'd had a lot more Americans killed. I mean, who knows? He made a decision, and what follows that decision is going to be tied to him, whether he likes or not, whether it's fair or not.
Yeah, but he could have done it in a more competent way, and that undermines.
Even that, I mean, again, I don't know. I mean, maybe, but
and I'm not
you just can't control what the Taliban's going to do.
Well, how about not abandoning the airbase before you get American citizens out of the country? I mean, it just how about not doing it during the fighting season? If you do the withdrawal in a different, you know, not during the fighting season, and you do not, you know, we had to send back 6,000 troops. Like, that's obviously not.
But if Americans get killed in the fighting season. When Biden said before he was going to get out, that's a problem too, politically speaking. There's the whole problem with Afghanistan is that there are no good answers. There's no good solution. There's no pat solutions. And I mean, Biden made a call, and he's going to have to own the call and own the consequences of that call. But I have some sympathy to the fact that I can't know if the other recourses would have been any better. And if there, I'm all for investigations, hearings. Pinpointing where the problems might have been avoided, all of it could well be true. I think it's also possible that you could do everything perfectly here and it still would have been a total mess.
Yeah. All right. I could keep going, but I won't.
All right. We DM Zooming?
Do you want to?
Yeah.
All right. Let me look at my calendar. I think I can do it.
We don't have to schedule
on
the show.
Right. Taping this early. Okay. Cool. We will talk tomorrow, and then if you're out there and you're a big fan, tentatively, we will DM Zoom on Friday. Follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. And this is cool, Bill. I just interviewed Terry Dresbach, who is a Patreon supporter of mine, and she's a award-winning costume designer, and she did the costumes for Outlander. For example. But we didn't really talk about that much. She more or less interviewed me. She's a self-described leftist, but she's very open-minded, obviously, if she supports my podcast. And she wanted to know why it seemed obvious to her that the Republican Party, for years, she had figured it would end up with someone like Donald Trump. And she wanted to know why people like me didn't see that coming. And so we had that talk, and we haven't even posted it yet, but it was a great conversation. So check that out.
All right. Check out my latest at the monthly about the infrastructure reconciliation deal. You also had a piece of Real Clear Politics that was a preview of what happened, which I still think holds up. So if you want to fully catch up on things, read that one as well. And I'll talk to you later in the week, hopefully.
You got it. We'll see you back here in the DMZ next week.
Take care.